Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe, titled Europe, Religion, Integration. Our speaker is Olivia Roy, professor of social and political theory at the European University Institute. Tonight's moderator is Pardee School research professor Jessica Stern. We begin with an introduction by Kathy Jo Martin, professor of political science at Boston University.
Well, it is my very great honor today to present Professor Olivia Roy from the European University Institute, who really needs no introduction. Professor Roy has done fascinating work on extremist movements and the true roots of religious radicalism. He received his PhD from the Institut d'Etudes Politiques de Paris, and he's the author of many seminal books, The Failure of Political Islam, Secularism Confronts Islam, Holy Ignorance When Religion and Culture Part Ways, among others. Professor Roy has also offered his expertise to the solution of real-world problems, and I'm in great admiration of you for that. He's been a consultant to the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the United Nations Office of the Coordination for Afghanistan, among others. And then we are lucky to have BU's own Jessica Stern to comment on Professor Roy's comments. Professor Stern is an expert on the perpetrators of violence and linkages between trauma and terror. She's the author of ISIS, The State of Terror, among other things, Denial, A Memoir of Terror. We're very excited about this. So without further ado, I'd like to ask you to tell us about the true roots of political Islam and culture and the topic of the day.
Thank you very much. In fact, there are two topics in one. One, of course, is about the radicalization process. But I would like to draw a greater picture, you know, of the religious and the issue of religion integration in Europe. Because we cannot, of course, isolate the religious radicalization among Muslims from the greater picture, not necessarily of religious radicalization, but more exactly on the complex relationship between secularization and religion, specifically in Europe. You know, we'll speak essentially about Europe, but there are some comparisons to do with the USA. The opposition to Islam, I would say, is complex. In fact, we have two genealogies of anti-Islamophobia, let's say. I don't like the word, but let's use it, you know, in Europe. One is the traditional rightist and populist opposition to immigration. And for these people, the fact that the immigrants are Muslims is an aggravating factor, but the core issue is about migration. For the left, it's more complex. The left had a more open view towards immigration, but the left, especially in France, the left believe in integration. Roughly speaking, you know, you have two views, multiculturalism and integration. In Northern Europe, it's more multiculturalism. In Southern Europe, it's more integration. But the multiculturalism paradigm is in crisis, total crisis, everywhere, for reasons I will develop. You know. So the big problem for the left, or the liberals, let's say, is when migrants give birth to Muslims. You know. The traditional Islam of the first generations was not a problem. It was seen as some sort of cultural Islam. And in a sense, it was true. You know. The problems arose when the second generation, which was supposed to be integrated, began, on the contrary, you know, to show new forms of explicit religiosity. In France, the turning point is 1989, when two second generation Muslim girls, who were totally French, you know, by language, by the way they dress, the relationship with the other school boys and school girls. And two girls who were very successful at school, in the last year of secondary school, they came to the lycée wearing a scarf. And it was a huge scandal, you know. Not just because of the scarf, but because the scarf was worn by girls who were supposed to be the most integrated girls. So the scandal is here, you know. There was no problem with the scarf of their grandmother. By the way, their mother didn't wear the scarf. So it's not a cultural tradition. And the family, their own family, was not happy about the girls wearing the veil. So it's not a traditional imposition by the father of the veil and so on. So it's a choice. And that was the second scandal. Why would a young educated girl willingly wear a sign of, let's say, male oppression and traditional culture and so on and so on? The real issue, and still the same problem, is not, you know, how should we adapt to a foreign culture? But on the contrary, what happens when there is no more a culture? When religion is no more embedded into a culture? When we are confronted with what I call, the term is not very good, but pure religion? And it was a double scandal. For the right, you know, the problem is, well, Islam is not a Christian. We are a Christian Europe, you know. And they want to be Muslims in a Christian Europe. There is a problem. But for the left, the issue was we are in a secular Europe, and they want to bring back religion, you know, in the middle of the public space, while for it took us 2 centuries to get rid of religion. So I would say the liberal Islamophobia was more religiophobia. While the conservative rightist Islamophobia was more a variant of racism. But now we have a conjunction of both. And I will explain a bit more about that. We cannot speak of a religious right and a secular left in Europe. It's finished. It's finished because secularization won. Let's be very clear. There is no more religious conservative right in Europe. There used to be. It's done. The new rightist generation, Cameron, Berlusconi, Berlusconi is not so new, but the kind of right he represents is new. Rajoy in Spain, Sarkozy in France, you know. All these guys are not religious. They may say that they are Catholic, okay. They don't, or Catholic or Protestant. They don't go to Mass, and they don't refer to Christian values. They may refer to Christian identity, but they don't refer to Christian values. And the change, as you know, happened in the 60s. Until the 60s, roughly speaking, we could say that the secular values of Europe were Christian secularized values. In the 50s, abortion was banned almost everywhere. There was not only there was no story about same-sex marriage, but homosexuality was criminalized in Great Britain, in France, and so, and in other countries. The definition of the family, roughly speaking, was the same. You know, for instance, in France, the Communist Party opposed contraception until 67. Because for the party, contraception was a bourgeois way, you know, of ignoring the problems of the working class and so on and so. So the feuds were political, and by the way, in France, what is called the laïcité was not so much, you know, a debate between atheism and religion. It was a fight between the Republicans and the Catholic Church. It was a political fight, a political struggle. The French Protestants and the French Jews were on the side of laïcité, because for both, for sometimes very good reasons, the problem was the Catholic Church and not secularism. And the law on 1905 in France is not a law on values, norms, and so on and so. It's a law about what is the room for religious practices, and specifically Catholic practices, in the public space. What are the relationships between the state and the church? But from the 60s, as you know, a new sort of value system came and became slowly dominant in Europe, a value system based on freedom, absolute freedom, equality of gender, you know, individual freedom. And so the divorce between religious values and secular values started from there. It's very interesting to see that the Council Vatican II, in 1962, 1964, was in a sense the way how the Catholic Church acknowledged secularization in theological terms. You know, the Catholic Church retooled, if I can say that, its theology to adapt it to a secular society. So the Council Vatican II was seen as a triumph, in a sense, of secularization. And hardcore of Catholic integrists did oppose the Council. And even somebody like Cardinal Ratzinger, who was a key actor of the Council, after the Council came to the conclusion that we went too far. We went too far because it's not just, you know, adapting liturgy to a more secular society. There is a divorce in terms of values. And in 67, to the big surprise of the secularists, Pope Paul VI wrote the encyclical letter Humanae Vitae. Humanae Vitae. Which was totally concentrated on sexuality. The idea that contraception is bad, abortion, of course, is bad, and we should stick to the natural law, which is the same than God's law, and so on, and so on, and so on. So. It was a big surprise for the secularists because they thought that, well, in the wake of the Council Vatican II, the church would become more open to contraception, to the marriage of priests, the role of women in the church, and so on. So it was the contrary. The secularization process of Europe did extend a lot. We are a secularized society, a secularized societies, one by one. Every time we used to say there is an exception, the exception disappeared in the 10 years following the statement. You know, a good example is Ireland. You know? In the 70s, Ireland was a very strong Catholic country, and now the Catholic Church in Ireland has lost. You know? And not only because of the scandal of pedophilia. You know, it was the more in-depth than that. Then we said, oh, there is Spain. And in Spain, just the statistic has been released, the number of couples who decide to marry in the church has fallen from 76 in 2000 to 22% last year. So it's a clear indication. We have Poland. Let's wait 10 years. But everywhere the religious practice is falling, everywhere the youth doesn't go to the seminary anymore. We have the church has to import, you know, migrants from Africa to be priests. You know, they are well formed, they are well trained, but still is a sign. And as I said, the right is no more fighting for Christian values. In Spain, you know, the young guard of the right is even, you know, pushing for pregnancy by proxy, I don't know the term in English, which for the church is an absolute scandal. And I would say, except in Germany, you have almost no more Christian political leaders in Europe. And Germany, certainly enough, they are Protestant, you know. Not only the chancellor, but also the minister of foreign affairs. And it's in the midst, you know, of this very rapid and in-depth secularization of Europe that Islam is coming. Mm-hmm. And we can say, and I do say that, that the Muslims are experiencing also a secularization process. That's not the common wisdom. The common wisdom is Islam is challenging Europe for two contradictory reasons. Either they refuse secularization, or Islam is not compatible with Christianity. You know, you have two contradictory arguments, if I can say that. But if we study the religious practices, there is no real increase of religious practices. We should better speak about more visibility of religious practices. And it's exactly the same with Christianity. And it's very logical. The more a society is secular, the more religion is visible. Because you do not have the intermediate, the gray zone, you know, between hardcore believers and atheists. The traditional sociology of religion was based on the idea of, okay, on one hand, you have at the one end of the spectrum, you have the hardcore believers. On the other end of the spectrum, you have the atheists. But then you have the people who believe but don't practice, the people who go to church just for family events, the people who claim to be religious but are not really religious, and so on and so. This is disappearing. And for a very good reason, the faith communities do not accept anymore the gray zones, even the Catholic Church, except in Italy. For the moment, because for the church, religion is part of the culture. But in France, more and more parish priests, for instance, refuse to celebrate a religious wedding if the couple, or at least one of the couple, is not a regular customer of the church. No. The idea is you have no, to marry at the church is not a right. No. You have to prove that you are part of the community. And the term community everywhere is replacing the term of parish. Parish is a territorial entity. So if you are in the parish and you have a certificate of baptism, until recently you were entitled, you know, to use the services of the church, no more. Huh? And people tend more and more everywhere to do what they, what is very common in the USA, you don't go to a church or because it's close, it's your parish. You go to a church where you have the same sensitivity, yeah, where you share, you know, the religiosity, the ideas, and so on. So even if you have to drive 50 kilometers. And for the Muslims, it's the same, exactly the same. We have a disconnection between traditional Islam and religious signs. So the traditional, for instance, the grandmother with her traditional Algerian dress has disappeared, or nobody cares. But so. And you have a dissociation between the religious marker and the cultural marker. Two examples, the scarf. Yeah. The scarf is not a traditional veil. The burqa is not traditional at all, you know. It's a reconstruction of a religious sign. And another religious sign is halal. Until now, halal was not a problem because if you go to a Moroccan couscous restaurant, it's halal, okay. And if you go to a McDonald's, it's not halal. The scandal, and in France it was a big scandal, was then one fast food chain, Quick, yeah, decided to go halal because they saw that that big Muslim, many of their customers were Muslim, and of course for this kind of fast food. They cannot have two kitchens and so on and so. So they used to say, well, the Muslims care about halal, the non-Muslims don't care, so let's be halal. And there was an uproar. Demonstrations, you know, in front of the restaurants and so on and so. Think we don't want to eat religious. So you see, everything is concentrated on the visibility of Islam, not on the faith, but on the visibility. Minarets in Switzerland, burkini in France, burqa everywhere, the mosques, and so on and so. And the issue of visibility is here precisely because there is no more, you know, a connection between traditional cultures, Christian or Muslims, and religion. So religion now appears everywhere as something at best a bit weird, at worst fanatical. And the same for the Catholics and for the Muslims. If you see a Franciscan monk in the street, everybody is looking at, you know, what is this guy? And he's supposed to be an integrist or a fanatic, or something like that. You don't find any nuns in full garb, you know, except at the gay pride. And that's normal, you know. But outside the gay pride, people look at her. What are you doing here? You know. Here we have the big contradiction, you know, and this way it's so tense. Both the right and the left, I wouldn't say all the people who think that there is a problem with Islam, say the problem is a problem of compatibility. But then they use two different terms. Some says there is a problem of compatibility between Islam and European values. And other says there is a problem of compatibility between Islam and the Christian identity of Europe. The problem is, are the European values Christian? Can we say that, yes, Europe is Christian, so the European values are Christian? No. Not at all. For instance, you know, the German consulate have a questionnaire for would-be migrants or would-be refugees, where they are asked to if they know the German values. And among the German values, you have gay rights. You have nudity, that it's legitimate. Nudity in public space is legitimate. You know. You have feminism. So the problem is that such a questionnaire would the Pope could not sign, you know, such a questionnaire. Interestingly enough, apparently there is no such questionnaire in the German consulate in Salt Lake City, you know. Only in Marrakech, Tunis, and Istanbul. If you take the populists now, that's very interesting because the populists love to speak about the Christian identity of Europe, but none of them is supporting Christian values, of course. You know, you know the story of Geert Wilders, the Dutch populist. No. He's a hero for all the kind of Islamophobic people. He's a hero. Because he's probably the most Islamophobic politician in Europe. He wants to ban Islam. That's all, you know. Not Islamist, not Salafist, but Islam as such. To close the mosque and to forbid the sale of the Quran. Okay, so very. He was invited recently by American evangelicalists, I don't remember if in Texas or Alabama, he was a guest, the honor guest, you know. And as long as he spoke against Islam, you know, everybody was clapping. And then he went on. And the Muslims, they cannot respect the European values, gay rights. And even in France, Marine Le Pen, for instance, has shifted from the Christian identity to the secular identity. As she says, the French identity is based on laïcité. She didn't say anything against Christianity, of course. So the church is now in an awkward situation. The church thinks that there is a Christian identity of Europe. The church struggled to have the Christian identity put into the European Constitution. They lost, but they tried very hard. But the church cannot accept the secular values of the populists, Guerrais, right, abortion, and so on and so. And the church still claims that charity, hospitality, love are part of the Christian values. You know. So there is an interesting point here. There is regularly a fight between the populist and the church. In Milano, for instance, with the previous archbishop, when he said we should open the churches to the migrants. No? So the Lega Nord, the populist movement, they asked for the resignation of the bishop. In Austria, the Cardinal Schönborn asked the populist not to use the cross on their leaflets. The cross is not a message of xenophobia. You have no right to use the cross. No? And regularly in France too, you know, the church used to remind the populists that there are Christian values, you know, and you cannot take the identity without the values. So from that, what is the position of the Muslims? Well, the church has a problem to open to Islam, because the church still think that Europe is Christian. And sometimes the church is quite divided on that. They say that, well, the problem of Islam as a religion is that it's not compatible with the Christian values, some Christian values, and concept of dignity, for instance. So the church has a problem to create, to set up a coalition of the religious people against same-sex marriage, abortion, and so on. But a hardcore Catholic group, like the Manif pour tous in France, for the first time, they went to the streets. It's totally new to have Catholics going to the streets as Catholics. No? Usually, they would have joined either rightist conservative parties or even some populists. But these rightist, conservative Catholics, they cannot ally with the National Front, not because they are more liberal than the populists, but because they are more conservative. Mm-hmm. So we have a reverse of alignments. Mm-hmm. The Manif pour tous blame now the populists for accepting gay rights. Mm-hmm. And for accepting abortion. So on the issue of values, they are on the right of the populists. But they think that, well, we may make an alliance with good Muslims, with conservative Muslims, at one condition that they accept that, yes, they are a minority in Europe, and that Christianity is the dominant religion in Europe. But interestingly enough, except some radical Salafi groups, many conservative believing Muslims agree on that. For instance, you know, there is a big fight now in France on the nativities in municipal halls. Some municipalities, and it's a tradition, they put nativity at the time of Christmas, you know, in the hall, municipal hall. And there have been a lot of suits, especially last year, against that. But the suits were not done by Jews or Muslims. The suits were done by militant secularists. We say the separation of state and church, and same story here, you know, there should not be any kind of religious symbols in the municipal halls. While the Muslims are quite happy about the nativity, you know, they say, at least we have a veiled woman, you know, in the public space. You know? And there is no pork. the guy is named Yusuf. The mother is named Mariam. And the child is Prophet Isa. They love that. You know? It's a halal thing. So we have some kind of reverse alliances, you know, in this case. So my point is here, you know, the main problem of Europe is not a civilizational fight between Islam and Christianity. it's precisely the main problem is the deculturation of religion, of every kind of religion, you know, and the reconstruction of faith communities who don't think that they belong to the same mainstream. They could do that, you know, with a nostalgia, like many conservative Catholics, the idea that Europe should and could come back to its Christian roots. That was the motto of Pope Benedict. You know, he was always saying, the dominant culture is a secular culture of death. But Europe should go back to its Christian roots, you know, which means coming back to faith, of course, you know, and not just to folklore. But all what we see is that it doesn't work, you know. The more the church is visible, the less people go to church. If you compare the curve of the attendance to the World Youth Day, when the Pope, you know, every year brings hundreds of thousands, millions of youth in a given place, well, the curve is going, the line is rising, you know, every year more and more youth. But if you look at the curve of the young entering into a Catholic seminary, it's going down. So we can say the more, there are two explanations. Either the more the people see the Pope, the less they want to be priests. So that's the explanation. Apparently, it's not the explanation. The explanation is they are not interested in institutional church. No. They go to meet the Pope for spirituality, for the fun. I've been at the last, you know, and it was like after, you know, a big football match between the people were drinking, singing, and making fun, you know, except that there was more nuns and priests than usual, you know. So we have no rebirth of Christianity in Europe at all. And so we have this kind of triangle, you know, a secular culture, Islam being a more deculturated Islam, and Christianity being also deculturated, but trying, you know, to go back, you know, to something which, in fact, never existed. And the last issue is, I would say, the consequences. The problem is that secularism is not a religion, contrary to what many people say. You know, secularism as religion has replaced Christianity. No, no, and we see that very clearly in France. You don't have a secular spirituality. There might be secular spirituality. The Freemasons last century, in the 19th century, made a very interesting endeavor to construct, you know, a secular spirituality, artistic view, and so and so. But it doesn't work anymore like that, you know, that's so. You have the so-called new religious movements, you know, Zen, neo-Buddhist, post-Buddhism, after-Buddhism, what you want, you know. It's not a real spirituality. And secularism appears to the religious people as just a normative system, which is clearly the case in France. A normative system to exclude a religion from the public space. So the problem is that we are letting spirituality and religion to the margins, to the radicals. A good example, I just take that as an example, the jails. After years and years of denial, everywhere in Europe, the authorities accepted the well-known idea that jails are probably, after or with internet, the place of radicalization for Muslims. No, it's not the mosque, no, it's jail. Okay. And you can understand how it works, you know. It works in jail is not a nice place. No. So where, when you are a young boy in jail for petty delinquency, you have a tough life. So you are looking for brotherhood, and you are looking for norms, and you are looking for resistance, a way, you know, to resist the institution. For those of you who know the series Oz, you know, 20 years ago, it's exactly that, you know. And the radicals, the guy who turned Salafi or jihadist in jail, they are the same age, same social background. But these guys are tough guys. They know to resist to the administration. They become leaders, very rapidly, leaders of the inside. And many young, they become born again, or they convert. They convert. We have a lot of conversions. So when they go out of the jail, they might go. Not necessarily, but they might go for terrorism, jihadism, and so. So my colleague Farhad Rosro-Ravar had identified the problem 10 years ago. And recently, the administration called him back, you know, say, okay, we acknowledge the problem. Now, what should we do? And one of the answers the experts said was, you have to appoint Muslim chaplains in jail. The administration, at the end, said, okay, they did that. Except that, especially in France, you know. No chaplain has the right to contact the prisoners, the detainees. They are waiting in an office that a detainee calls for the chaplain. So every detainee has the right to call for a chaplain. It's a constitutional right. But they should file a form. And in the form, it's written, what is your religion? So if you put Catholic, okay, you have the Catholic chaplain. If you put Muslim, you have a Muslim chaplain. But you have no right to say, well, I don't know whom I am. I'm looking, you know, and I would like to meet the rabbi, the imam, and the priest. No. You have to make a choice. No. And Muslim chaplain has no right to look after the people who are radicals, because, of course, the radicals will never call a chaplain, because for them, he's a traitor. Yeah. So you see how we manage very badly this issue of spirituality. No? There is no space, you know, in the name of secularism, we in fact destroy, you know, any space of spirituality. In Italy, it's better because the priest has not only the right, but he considers that he has a duty, you know, to knock at every door, you know, every cell, and to tell the guys, hello, I am Don. I am the priest. You are not. You are Muslim. It doesn't matter. We can have a chat and so and so. You know. So he engaged the detainees. And probably it's more complex than that. Sure, but we have less cases of radicalization in Italian jail. But of course, the carceral population is not the same. It's why, and we'll stop on that, you know. I didn't touch the issue of Islamic radicalization. I touched the issue of the spiritual landscape and the main problem, which is for me at the roots of the issue, is the crisis of the link between religion and culture in Europe. And this crisis does touch the Muslims, and very fast, you know. And it entails not a cultural backlash. There is no cultural backlash. It accelerates the deculturation of Islam, and it opens, you know, the space to Salafism, which is not terrorism, sure, but might help, you know, to create a fertile ground for more political radicalization. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's such a great pleasure to have you here. We're so lucky you were willing to come across the river and talk to us. I know people work on many different areas of the world in the room, but I want to ask you about where we are right now. You are visiting a traumatized nation. We are facing an introduction of religion into political life in an entirely new way. I know you've been thinking about these issues for so many years, and also you have been part of a project that also looked at the United States. It would mean a lot, I think, to everyone to hear your wisdom about what this means, this cynical reintroduction of religion into political life.
That's a very good question. I just mentioned for publicity that we wrote a book with Nadia Marzouki. It's a collective book, Saving the People, How the Populists Hijack Religion. You know, the book is out. And there is a chapter on America and the USA done by Nadia Marzouki. Because she worked 5 years ago, she made a field work in Alabama on, you know, when there was a campaign to ban Sharia. Mm-hmm. And how is it that there is a campaign to ban Sharia in a place where you have no Muslims? You know, no Sharia, of course, but no Muslims. You know? So I recommend you the reading. Interestingly enough, I think that what is going on in the USA fits with what I am saying about Europe. You know? We have a growing secularization. Mm-hmm. Of course, still a huge majority of Americans claim to be believers. But we know that it's very classical in sociology of religion. There is a gap between what people claim to be and what they really do. Secondly, there is a rise of the no. People will say, I don't belong. And then we have the same phenomena which I described with Berlusconi, Sarkozy. The rightist politicians are no more believers. I no more religious people. No. It's funny. No, it's not very funny, but that the conservatives, evangelicals, have been unable to promote a Christian as the head of the candidate of the Republican Party. At the end, they rally Trump because they say, "Okay, these guys, we know he's not one of us." But at least, you know, he will promote, he will do our policy. But for me, it's suicidal. For the church, not for Trump, not yet at least. Because what do we see? We see first that the clash of values is obvious. No. There are only the norms of the church and no more the values of the church. So they choose somebody who is totally outside the world of religious values, but who is ready to implement some religious norms, you know, in order to keep its constituency. And especially with Christianity, but there's some problem with Islam, you know, elsewhere. If a religion is just a set of norms, you know, it dies as a religion. Because people, they don't go to a religion for the norms. They go for precisely spirituality, values, and so. I'll give you an example. Poland, you know. In a sense, we can say that what did happen in Poland is very close to what happened in the USA. You have a populist party claiming, you know, to fight in the name of religious norms, you know, and to reinstall Catholicism as a state religion, to close the borders, to build walls, and so on and so. They are very close, in a sense. And when they decided to drastically limit abortion, you had a huge demonstration of women, so like here. And it's not the parliament who backstepped, you know, it's the church. The church said, no, we are going too far. Yeah. And of course, the influence of the Pope here was there. You know, the Pope said, the message of the Christ is not just a message about norms. You know, it's not just a message about don't. It's a message also about charity, about love, and so and so. Many bishops were not happy about this reminder, you know. Okay. But that's a good thing with the church, you know. they have to obey. Many don't obey, by the way. Cardinal Burke didn't obey at all, you know. But here, it's, I would say, it's a part of the church which understood that to follow the normative populist is the kiss of death. And I think, so I'm not an expert in the USA at all, you know better than me, I think that many religious people here think the same. We had in Florence a research project, you know, Religio West on this issue, and we invited, you know, some very conservative Catholic, like Professor George Weigel from... Weigel was very clear. He told us, you know, it was 6 months ago, he would never vote for Trump. Never. He said, I will abstain because I can't vote for Hillary, of course, but never. So I think, you know, the crisis will now go to the religious milieus. And sooner or later, you know, this alliance between cynical populists and religious milieus will not necessarily disappear, but will collapse to a certain extent. And that's the hope, you know.
Professor Roy, welcome again. I'm Bob Hefner, as you know. We actually have met a number of times, most recently in Singapore. I don't know if you remember, just back in May.
We're global people, you know.
But I'd like to focus again on the question of populism, but link it also to your 10-year rule. I know it wasn't really a rule. It was just a casual observation. But I can link those two through the question of whether the linkage of cynical populism, or let's just call it instrumental populism, with mass-based religious organizations is always destined not to work. Clearly, if we look at the case of much of Europe today, I think you're absolutely right. If we look at Iran, which has, of course, been playing with conservative populist alliances between utterly unscrupulous politicians and various Islamist groups, it's, you know, it's provoked the greatest secularization of Muslim society in the entire Muslim world. And so those examples work, but I wonder if we look at other parts of the world, whether we might not say, not that the alliance is always good, but the outcome can be much more varied. In particular, since we're already getting hints here, as in some other countries, I think if we go to the Buddhist world, we see many in Southeast Asia, Burma, Thailand, many opportunistic politicians, populist politicians, clothing themselves in the garb of religiosity and sort of being regarded as unscrupulous, but not, if you will, provoking this grand decline of religiosity. I wonder if in the United States, so here's my really focused question, I wonder if in the United States the constellation of forces that underlies the current populist alliance between, yes, I agree, an utterly unscrupulous, cynically manipulative politician and at least the conservative wing of the religious community might be less damaging to that conservative community because simply the state of secularity in the United States is still so much different than in Western Europe. Thank you.
I don't know. You know better. You know, still, the conservative religious constituencies are very diverse in different places. I think that some conservative religious people will stick with the populists because they think that it's a cultural issue, that they are defending, you know, a traditional cultural alliance between religion and national identity and things. As long as you think like that, yes, you can consider that the cost-benefit relation is with the populist is good. Now. But very different people could see things differently. And if we look at the Muslim countries, like you say, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Indonesia, but you know better, right? I will not touch Indonesia. We can, at first glance, we say, the populists are totally playing, you know, on the popular religiosity, things like that. But this violence, I'm referring to Pakistan, for instance, has also consequences, you know, inside the society. In a sense, you have more and more dissent. We have no data, or very few data. But what I see with my colleagues from Morocco to Indonesia is a diversification of the religious field, of the Muslim religious field. More people claiming to be atheists, people converting to Christianity in particular, or people claiming that they have the right to have their own kind of Islam. It's very interesting to see that from Morocco to Egypt, it's not the Islamists who push, for Tafa populist norms, or Tafa, pseudo-religious norms, like fighting homosexuality and so. It's the authoritarian regimes. You had no trial against homosexuals in Tunisia when Nahda had the majority, or in Egypt when the Muslim Brothers had the majority. And now that you are supposedly have a more secular government in Tunisia, you have dozens of trials against homosexuals. Same thing in Morocco. Same thing in Egypt and Assisi. So the way I will not say Sisi is not a populist, but he played largely on the populist card. I think that the populists are overdoing, by thinking that, in fact, their basis is far more conservative than it is in reality. And that we could see also an opening of the religious field. I see an opening of the religious field because more diversification of the opening field, which will undermine, the equivalence made by the populists between religion and the people, the nation. And so in Poland also we'll have that.
Thank you so very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Olivia Roy, professor of social and political theory at the European University Institute, titled Europe, Religion, Integration. Our lecture was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Tonight's moderator was Pardee School research professor Jessica Stern. We began with an introduction by Kathy Jo Martin, professor of political science at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Mike Moschetto. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.